Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This name became an impediment to our efforts to diversify. And because we're trying to look forward, we're like, yeah, we got to ditch it. We got to lose it. We got to get a name that doesn't present a barrier to everybody's participation. We're throwing the doors open for everybody and saying you're all welcome and burning.
New York City's chapter of the Audubon Society has officially changed its name to the NYC Bird Alliance. John Audubon, the founding father of American birding, was a slaveholder. As we mark Pride Month, we speak to Christian Cooper, a black birder and LGBTQ activist. He made headlines 4 years ago when a white woman in Central Park called 911 claiming he was threatening her life after he asked her to leash her dog.
She told me first, I'm going to call the police and tell them that an African-American man is threatening my life. And of course, you know, I'm like, whoa, you know, I'm not an idiot. I've grown up as a black man in America my whole life. I know this is a world of hurt potentially coming my way, but you know, I'm not gonna acquiesce to this and let this intimidate me.
Christian Cooper just won an Emmy for his National Geographic series, Extraordinary Birder. But first, we look at the Supreme Court's unanimous decision preserving access to the abortion pill mifepristone. The pill is used in nearly two-thirds of all U.S. abortions. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Children in Gaza continue to die of hunger. On Thursday, the World Health Organization reported 32 deaths from malnutrition, most of whom were children under five. The findings came as UNICEF said nearly 3,000 children have been cut off from treatment for moderate and severe acute malnutrition in southern Gaza, putting them at risk of death. Meanwhile, the UN reports violence against children caught in armed conflict last year reached extreme levels, with a 21% increase in extreme violations. The surge in violence came amidst Israel's withering assault on the Gaza Strip, now in its ninth month. Overnight, Israeli forces pushed deeper into the Shabura refugee camp in Gaza. Elsewhere, one person was killed and three children wounded after Israel bombed their home in the Berej refugee camp. Israeli airstrikes in northern Gaza City killed at least 14 people. Meanwhile, Israeli forces killed at least three Palestinians in overnight raids in the West Bank. The U.S. Supreme Court Thursday ruled unanimously to maintain access to the abortion pill mifepristone, which is used in nearly two-thirds of all U.S. abortions. The decision comes as a relief to providers and patients across the nation. But advocates warn the far-right-dominated court's ruling on the FDA's authority to regulate the pill was purely on procedural grounds and could even offer a roadmap for future challenges. Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote in the court's decision, quote, "The plaintiffs have sincere legal, moral, ideological, and policy objections, suggesting the proper venue for their case could be with the president, lawmakers, or federal regulators." We'll have more on this ruling after headlines with Professor Michelle Goodwin. In other Supreme Court news, justices ruled 8-1 in favor of Starbucks, which was accused of unlawfully firing seven workers at a Memphis store after they led a campaign to organize a union. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson was the sole dissenter. Lynn Fox, president of Workers United, said the decision, quote, "underscores how the economy is rigged against working people all the way up to the Supreme Court," unquote. In Italy, G7 leaders have agreed on a plan to loan Ukraine $50 billion. G7 host and far-right Italian President Giorgia Meloni said Russian assets frozen after its 2022 invasion of Ukraine would be used to finance the deal. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky joined the talks, where he met with President Biden and signed a 10-year bilateral security agreement with the U.S. Biden announced the agreement at a joint news conference.
A lasting peace for Ukraine must be underwritten by Ukraine's own ability to defend itself now and to deter future aggression anytime in the future. The United States is going to help ensure that Ukraine can do both, not by sending American troops to fight in Ukraine, but by providing weapons and ammunition, expanding intelligence sharing, continuing to train brave Ukrainian troops at bases in Europe and the United States.
On Thursday, at least 6 people were killed and 11 others wounded when a Russian missile struck the city of Kryvyi Rih in southern Ukraine. Much of Ukraine is experiencing extended blackouts as Russia's military increases attacks on the energy grid. As G7 leaders gathered for a lavish banquet Thursday evening, protesters gathered to host what they called a poor dinner.
A world with people who are getting richer and richer, and a world, a planet that is getting poorer and poorer, crossed by wars, death, destruction, climate change. So a planet that is going towards death, and they don't seem to care. We are on the eve of the Third World War.
Russian authorities say Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich will stand trial on espionage charges in Yekaterinburg, where he was arrested in March last year. The Wall Street Journal CEO and publisher slammed the what he called a sham trial, adding, quote, journalism is not a crime. If convicted, Gershkovich faces up to 20 years in prison. Christophe Deloire, the head of Reporters Without Borders for the last 12 years, has died at the age of 53 from complications of brain cancer. Deloire fought tirelessly to defend press freedom and persecuted journalists. A year ago, he appeared on Democracy Now!, where I asked him about Evan Gershkovich.
Is clearly a Russian state hostage, a sort of institutional hostage. If we know how Putin succeeded in the past decade, he finalized it right after the beginning of the war, how he succeeded to extinguish, to re-suppress pluralism, independent journalism, to provoke an extinction in his own country.
To see our full interview with Christophe Deloire, you can go to democracynow.org. Here in New York, climate protests continued for a fourth day outside Citigroup headquarters Thursday, where police arrested 56 people, many of them elders. Thursday's protests, led by the group Third Act, came under the banner of the Rocking Chair Rebellion, which is part of the Summer of Heat series of actions. Senior citizens blocked Citigroup's entrance with more than 50 rocking chairs, demanding climate justice for future generations. Palestinian rights activists have also been protesting Citigroup this week, calling on the bank to stop funding Israel. The group Al-Auda says Citibank provided a $2.5 billion loan for Israel to purchase F-35 fighter planes in 2021 that the U.S. is now repaying. In Germany, climate experts say the high-level UN talks in Bonn have failed to make any progress on a global response to the climate catastrophe. This is Tasnim Esap of Climate Action Network International.
The climate talks in Bonn this year ended up with no results. And this is caused by a breakdown in the negotiations once again on finance. Rich nations, as they've done before, are not willing to make progress on their financial obligations to developing countries.
This comes as record-breaking extreme weather is being reported around the world. Authority in Athens shut down the Acropolis and other major sites during peak hours as Greece records its earliest ever seasonal heat wave. In Puerto Rico, the mayor of San Juan declared a state of emergency as the island reported widespread power outages, leaving some 350,000 customers without electricity Wednesday night amid soaring temperatures. Puerto Rico's power grid was taken over by the Canadian-American company Luma Energy in 2021, despite widespread public opposition. Puerto Ricans have continued to suffer persistent blackouts, yet pay some of the highest electricity rates in the United States. French President Emmanuel Macron has suspended voting reform in New Caledonia to allow, quote, a return to order, unquote. On a visit to the Pacific archipelago last month, Macron vowed to go ahead with the reform, which would grant voting rights to French residents of the colonized territory. But after Macron called a snap election Sunday, such a procedure could not go ahead until a new legislature is elected. At least 8 people have been killed in the recent unrest. Much of New Caledonia's indigenous Kanak community is seeking full independence from France. Here in the United States, Oklahoma Supreme Court has dismissed a lawsuit from the last two survivors of the 1921 Tulsa race massacre. An estimated 300 black people were killed when a white mob burned down what was known as Black Wall Street, the thriving African-American neighborhood of Greenwood. Viola Fletcher and Lessie Benningfield Randall are 110 and 109 years old. Their lawyers say they will request a rehearing by the Oklahoma Supreme Court and called on the Justice Department to open an investigation into the massacre under the Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crime Act of 2007. Former President Donald Trump returned to the U.S. Capitol on Thursday for the first time since the January 6, 2021 insurrection. Trump met with Republican lawmakers, among other things. He reportedly said, quote, "Milwaukee, where we're having our convention, is a horrible city," unquote. Trump narrowly lost Wisconsin to Biden in 2000 and has since falsely claimed election fraud in the state. This comes as Politico reports Trump called House Speaker Mike Johnson after he was convicted of 34 felonies in New York and asked the GOP leader to help overturn the verdict and to help punish the Justice Department. President Trump turns 78 years old today. And in Brazil, protesters took to the streets on Thursday after lawmakers advanced a bill this week that would equate all abortions with homicide if performed after the 22nd week of gestation, with punishments of up to 20 years in prison. This is Rio Councilmember Monica Benicio.
We will not accept a setback. We will not accept a conservative government negotiating spurious policies over our lives. We will continue to advance until legal abortion is a guaranteed right in Brazil.
Abortion is only legal in Brazil in cases of rape, anencephaly, or a life-threatening risk to the patient. And this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a closely watched case Thursday, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled to preserve access to the abortion pill mifepristone, which is used in roughly two-thirds of all U.S. abortions. The court did not address the safety of the pill and focused instead on the lack of standing by the anti-choice medical associations who filed a lawsuit in order to limit access to the drug approved more than 20 years ago by the Food and Drug Administration. Advocates warn the court's ruling could offer a roadmap for future challenges. Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote the majority opinion. He said, quote, "The plaintiffs have sincere legal, moral, ideological, and policy objections," unquote, suggesting the proper venue for their case could be with the president, lawmakers, or federal regulators. Vice President Kamala Harris spoke from the White House after the ruling.
"This is not a cause for celebration. Because the reality is certain things are still not going to change. We are looking at the fact that two-thirds of women of reproductive age in America live in a state with a Trump abortion ban. This ruling is not going to change that. This ruling is not going to change the fact that Trump's allies have a plan that, if all else fails, to eliminate medication abortion through executive action."
The Supreme Court will soon rule on another case that aims to strip pregnant people of their right to abortion care in order to stabilize an emergency medical condition. Meanwhile, Senate Republicans blocked a bill Thursday to protect access to in vitro fertilization and voted last week against the Right to Contraception Act. For more, we're joined by Michelle Goodwin, professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown University, founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy. She hosts the Ms. Magazine podcast on the issues with Michelle Goodwin and is the author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. In 2021, her guest essay for The New York Times was headlined, "I Was Raped by My Father and Abortion Saved My Life." Professor Goodwin, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you respond to the Supreme Court's unanimous decision, what it means and what it doesn't mean?
What it means is that mifepristone, which is used as part of a two-drug regimen in order to terminate pregnancy, it's the majority of pregnancy terminations, abortions in the country take place with mifepristone. What this means is that it continues to be available nationwide. It means that people may not be criminally punished for using this to help a patient terminate a pregnancy. But as the vice president said, it should not be overstated what this ruling means. This was a ruling on procedural grounds, not substantive grounds. And it's worth noting how far this group of litigants got. They framed themselves as doctors who would be affected by patients who had some distress, medical distress after abortion. That itself was something of a tremendous falsehood. Mifepristone is safer than using aspirin and Tylenol. The Supreme Court has acknowledged in 2016 that a woman is 14 times more likely to die carrying a pregnancy to term than by having an abortion. So the underlying premise that the drug is unsafe, that abortions are unsafe, was factually not true. It was also an incredible reach that somehow this claim that the FDA had rushed this drug to the marketplace, when in the year that it was approved, the FDA had spent three times the length of time reviewing this drug compared to other drugs that came into the marketplace that year. So the drug is efficacious and the drug was safe. And yet these plaintiffs were able to get as far as the Supreme Court in bringing this case. And that says so much.
What role does telemedicine play in providing access to abortion pills, and how will it be affected?
Well, what this also means is that telemedicine can continue to be used in order to help people be able to terminate a pregnancy. Part of the challenge to this case by these people who brought it, this is also important, Amy, these are people who claim to be doctors. Amongst them was a person who has a master's degree in theology who would never get medical admitting privileges at any hospital. Another one, a dentist who's not a person that one would seek to have help in a gynecological ward. But that said, they claim to be doctors who would be put in a difficult position helping someone to be relieved after complications with an abortion. What this case does do with telemedicine is that it keeps it alive. And it's important to understand the playbook behind all of this. Part of the playbook is to find any kinds of opportunities, holes, et cetera, and to pierce them to try to use the United States Supreme Court, district courts, courts of appeals in any kind of way to further limit and diminish the ability to be able to access reproductive freedom. And so it's not even just about abortion. You'll find that this case and others like it are open doors to also diminishing the right to access contraception, the ability to be able to get things in the mail that help you with your reproductive health. This is just one of the strikes, not the first strike, not the second or third, but one of the strikes in an artillery that is aimed at reproductive freedom.
Can you explain judge shopping, who the Trump-appointed judge Matthew Kaczmarek is in Amarillo, Texas, and what he has to do with this case?
This is a great question, because what's come open in the wake of so many of the appointments that the former president was able to make, Donald Trump was able to nominate and get through the confirmation process more federal judges than any other president save George Washington. And many of the people that were part of that nomination process were people who showed a coolness towards cases like Brown v. Board of Education, Roe v. Wade, et cetera. So Judge Kaczmarek is one of them. He was an activist, is an activist, an anti-abortion activist. He's written about his anti-abortion views. He has been quite outspoken about his anti-abortion views, save for a publication that he had had his name removed when he was going through the confirmation process, which was going to be published by a Texas University of Texas Law Review. He had his name taken off of that. But it was an article that was about abortion and his opposition. So this group of litigants brought their case before Judge Kaczmarek, who's the only sitting judge in Amarillo, Texas, a person with known anti-abortion views. And what they had hoped to do was to play off of his anti-abortion views by bringing this case before him. Now, what this also says is a lot about how the U.S. judiciary has been functioning in recent years. There's supposed to be objectivity. arm's length distancing, such that if one has personal views that may be oppositional on matters of race and sex and LGBTQ equality, that is not supposed to infect the process of judging. Many have said that that's exactly what happened in this case, that there was an infection that was here with Judge Matthew Kaczmarek, that he allowed his personal views, which have been widely expressed, to influence how he handled this case, including on the matter of standing. The fact that the United States Supreme Court unanimously threw out this case saying that these plaintiffs have no standing, it should not have gotten that far. And Judge Kaczmarek was the one who opened the door to it.
Professor Goodwin, what does the next move of anti-abortion crusaders look like based on this Supreme Court result? And if you can talk about EMTALA and what it means.
Yes. Well, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act says it all, doesn't it, in its name. When Congress enacted this law, it was intended to protect all Americans, and quite specifically, women who would be in distress during pregnancy. At the time in which this federal law was passed, there were poor pregnant women who were literally, Amy, being dumped on the side of roads. These were women who had no health insurance. Of course, there's not universal health care in the United States. Since EMTALA's enactment, there's been the federal protections of health care, the Obamacare, but it's not universal health care. But at the time, women were being dumped on the side of roads. Poor women were showing up at American hospitals in labor, sometimes in very stressful conditions. Women who needed miscarriage being managed. And they were literally being turned away because they didn't have insurance, or the right insurance. Because of deaths and tragedies that were associated with this, Congress passed this law, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, otherwise known as EMTALA, that grants all Americans the privilege, the right to be stabilized when they are in a healthcare crisis. You can imagine what this might mean if someone is suffering a heart attack, a stroke, needing to manage a miscarriage, going to a hospital, and the hospital saying, sorry, we can't stabilize you, we can't treat you. Well, there's another case that is being seen by the court, that the court will be ruling on soon, that involves Idaho's challenge to EMTALA's application to women who need their pregnancies managed, their miscarriages managed. Idaho claims that EMTALA should not apply to the state. This raises very serious questions in American constitutionalism, American rule of law, because federal law always supersedes and trumps states' laws. But in the wake of the anti-abortion movement and the forcefulness of it, you hear these kinds of claims coming from governors and states' attorneys general that federal law doesn't matter. Federal law cannot supersede or trump what the state is seeking to do specifically on matters of reproductive health. We saw that before the Dobbs decision when the state of Texas passed its SB 8 law, which banned abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy. That was a showdown against Roe v. Wade that the United States Supreme Court turned a blind eye to and let stand. Well, now Idaho is doing the same. We'll see how the Supreme Court comes out on this. But let me also say this, Amy. This issue of the Comstock Act, this Comstock law, dating back to 1873, it's another weapon in the arsenal of the anti-abortion movement. This is a playbook, so turning to the playbooks of times in which slavery existed or just after slavery, a time in which women couldn't vote, had very limited representation within law at all, times in which marital rape was permissible, marital domestic violence permissible. So part of the anti-abortion movement is to look back at a time in which women barely had citizenship by law in the United States and to pull from that past in order to inform the present and the future.
Michelle Goodwin, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Professor of Constitutional Law and Global Health Policy at Georgetown University, founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy, author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women, and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Coming up, New York City's chapter of the Audubon Society changes its name. Why? John Audubon, the founding father of American birding, was a slaveholder. Today, we mark Pride Month with the rest of the show speaking to Christian Cooper, black birder and LGBTQ activist. Made headlines 4 years ago when a white woman in Central Park called 911 claiming he was threatening her life after he asked her to leash her dog. Back in 30 seconds. Things You Are by Charlie Parker, affectionately known as Bird. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. New York City's chapter of the Audubon Society has officially changed its name to the NYC Bird Alliance. John Audubon, the founding father of American birding, was a 19th century French-American naturalist and a slaveholder who espoused racist views. In March, the National Audubon Society voted to retain the Audubon name. That set off a revolt among leaders of local chapters of the society. On Thursday, Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh and I spoke to Christian Cooper, longtime board member of New York City Bird Alliance. He's also a longtime LGBTQ activist and served as co-chair of the board of directors of GLAAD in the 1980s. In May of 2020, Christian Cooper made national headlines after a white woman in Central Park called 911 on him, falsely claiming that Cooper, who's black, was threatening her life. The woman, Amy Cooper, no relation to him or me, made the call after Christian Cooper asked her to follow park rules and put her dog on a leash. They were in an area of the park popular with birders. Video of the incident went viral in part because it happened on the same day that police in Minneapolis murdered George Floyd. Christian Cooper went on to write a memoir titled Better Living Through Birding, Notes from a Black Man in the Natural World. The paperback has just come out. He also hosted the National Geographic episode series Extraordinary Birder, for which he just won a Daytime Emmy Award in the Outstanding Daytime Personality category. I began by asking Christian about the NYC Bird Alliance's decision to drop the Audubon name.
So there's a couple of things you have to know about the Audubon name as sort of background. There's the National Audubon Society, of which the organization I'm in is a chapter, but there are many, many organizations that use the name Audubon, and they're not necessarily all affiliated with each other. So, you know, there's various Audubons that have nothing to do with National Audubon. So there's that. And then the other thing you need to know is that when the name Audubon was first assigned to a North American birding organization, it was by a bunch of ladies who lunch who decided to create a bird conservation organization, which is great. But Audubon was 50 years dead. He had nothing to do with the founding of the organization. It was these ladies who said, yeah, well, we'll name it after him because he was a major part of North American birding and making it so visible. So his name being attached to the organization, he really didn't have anything to do with the organization itself. And then there are lots of different organizations that use the name Audubon. So National Audubon decided not to change the name, and a lot of us chapters said, you know what? We're going to go and change our names anyway. So it's been sort of almost like dominoes. A lot of chapters have sort of settled on the name Bird Alliance, which is wonderful because it means that at least on the ground, the network is changing bit by bit and settling on a common name. So I know.
But tell us more about who John Audubon was.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, what you can't take away from him is that he put birds, North American birds, on the map. And that was principally through his amazing art. We're lucky enough to be in New York City, where the New York Historical Society has the original Audubon's, not the original prints, the original paintings. And I was lucky enough to see those at the New York Historical Society, and they are astonishing. They're gorgeous. You can't take that away from the guy. You do have to put an asterisk on it, which says, yeah, and his work was funded by the trafficking in other human beings. And it's that part that makes it very difficult for us looking forward when we're trying to diversify birding, which traditionally has been a very, very white activity, in the most diverse city in the world, or certainly in the country. So this name became an impediment to our efforts to diversify. And because we're trying to look forward, we're like, yeah, we got to ditch it. We got to lose it. We got to get a name that doesn't present a barrier to everybody's participation. We're throwing the doors open for everybody and saying, you're all welcome in birding.
But the National Audubon Society has not decided to go this route. What are the chapters? Some like Seattle?